what's wrong with American capitalism? Now, that question can be accented in a couple of ways. Like, one, what's wrong with American capitalism? You know? Or, what's wrong with American capitalism? And my accent comes in somewhere. I am a fan, in many respects, of American capitalism, and I'm very, very fearful of American capitalism in other respects. I don't intend to really answer that question. I make my living teaching economics, and therefore, I think I know, I have access to and familiar with a lot of data and ways of looking at things that you're not familiar with. And what I'd like to do these 2 days is start talking, using as my outline, these six, what I see as major kinds of criticisms that have been and are being leveled against capitalism, particularly American capitalism. And I want you to interrupt at any time with a question or a criticism of your own or an objection or because you're wondering about something. This will be most productive, I think, if I respond to the questions that you have in your mind. So I expect to be interrupted continually. Now I'm going to reserve the chairman's right to say, well, that'll come up better later, or we're getting off the track here. But if I think you're getting off the track, but you're still interested in it, well, we can talk about it after a while. I mean, I hang around, and I'd be delighted to talk about economics with anybody. So excited for people. Heavy size and interest. It's a subject that's frankly boring to most people, and I think that's too bad. I don't believe it has to be boring. And that's doubly unfortunate in that I think it's terribly important, although I also think it shouldn't be terribly important. All right, let's see. I guess let's take care of ground rules. Now, as I say, I have up here on the board six kinds of criticisms that have been are being leveled against American capitalism. And maybe you think of one that doesn't go under one of those headings. I assure you I found some way to squeeze it under one of them. Let's begin with the problem of inequality. Well, it's obvious that in America today, economic rewards are not equally apportioned. But who cares? We don't really want equality, do we? I don't think anybody really wants equality. In fact, perfect equality couldn't exist. If you gave every individual, or say every individual worker, the same income, you would have great inequality, wouldn't you? Because some people have different sized families than others. Some people have different tastes. I mean, here's a man, or say, suppose you gave each individual the same income, or each individual the same income based on his age, you'd still have great inequality because here's one man who derives supreme pleasure in life from sitting in a meadow and watching the larks. And you know, and you give him $5,000 a year and he's fabulously wealthy. Here's another man whose delight is motor cars, women, and song. And you've got to give him a lot more because our tastes are different. We all know some people can live well on a sum of money that other people can't begin to live on. So it turns out nobody's really that interested in equality. What we're interested in is equity. And when we talk about the inequality that's associated with capitalism, we really mean the inequity. But now there are all kinds of quagmires and pitfalls here too. You know, take the poverty level in the United States. Some years ago, some people said the government being so unsuccessful in the other war that it was waging, it decided to wage a war on poverty. And at the time, we decided to define poverty. And we decided that for any family receiving less than $3,200 a year, they'd be in poverty. Now, you know, that's kind of interesting. If you were to go back to the turn of the century, you would find that by that definition, and I mean adjusting for changes in the price level, the great majority of Americans were poor. And remember that at the turn of the century, America was considered the wealthiest country in the world. And the American wage earner of that time, who would be poor by the standards we use today, was the envy of everyone in Europe. Which, of course, suggests right away, and of course, $3,200 a year is undreamed of affluence for 90% of the people of the world. Well, it is obvious, but I think we need to remember and reflect deeply on what this means, that poverty is a relative condition. It is easy to be poor when everyone is poor. It hurts to be poor when other people are wealthy. Now, this isn't only because we are envious. It is also because we derive our expectations, don't we, from what other people have. I mean, I'm content, joyful. I say I have enough, and my neighbor buys wall-to-wall carpeting. You know, and down goes my standard. Or my neighbor adds on a big playroom in the back of his house, and suddenly I'm no longer as content as I was. But that isn't the only thing that happens. As a society gets wealthier, as your neighbors are getting wealthier, certain amenities, certain things that you enjoyed in a poorer age somehow go out of your reach. For example, you used to enjoy sitting in the meadow and watching the meadowlarks. But as economic growth occurs, somebody puts a suburban housing development in that meadow. As people become wealthier, they want to take their automobiles around the country. And consequently, you, who used to travel cheaply on the train, can't do it because the trains aren't running anymore. Or, as people get wealthy and take their automobiles, the public transportation system disintegrates. Well, there are many things that disintegrate or disappear. They're called inferior goods as people become wealthier. I mean, there are things we don't eat. Corn, bread, and beans, because we're too wealthy, and corn, bread, and beans are inferior goods. So somebody who needs corn, bread, and beans to survive finds it more difficult to get them. Well, this sort of phenomenon occurs in a society as it grows wealthier, and that's why, as some of us get richer, others of us automatically get poorer. And that suggests something connected with his second point. Many people have argued that because we have poverty in this country, the thing to do is crank up the rate of economic growth. And, you know, that means everybody's income will rise and we'll solve the problem of poverty eventually. It'll sort of trickle down to the poor. The trouble is, the evidence is pretty conclusive that when we crank up the rate of economic growth, the rich get richer a lot faster than the poor get richer. And cranking up the rate of economic growth is certainly not a good way to get rid of the problem of inequality or inequity. Well, you're not interrupting very well, but let me make that, and I'll make a point. I'm not going to say anything definitive about anything except this one. But that'll be so brief. I've got nasty viewpoints on this. Let me say one thing about inequality. This is a prediction, we will, in this society, within a short period of time, begin taking what would have been considered a few years ago rather extreme steps to eliminate some of the inequalities in the distribution of income in this country. I may be wrong. That's a prediction. I'm not saying it's good or bad. I think it's good, but there are dangers with it. I mean, the kind of thing that I expect us to move toward is redistribution of income in the form of some kind of income guarantees or negative income tax. And I think one can see the signs of the times. More and more congressmen are becoming sympathetic to this. The opposition is becoming weaker and weaker. The man who is regarded as the most conservative or the leading conservative economist in the country, Milton Friedman, who was Barry Goldwater's economic advisor, has been for some years a strong advocate of the negative income tax. He wants to use it to substitute for the whole range of welfare programs with which we, you know, sort of try to patch up the problem of inequality here and there. And his contention is he doesn't want the negative income tax. You all know what a negative income tax is? Oh, well, you know that the more you earn, the higher percentage of your income you pay. All right, you just extend that backwards so that the less you earn, the higher a chunk you get back, including more than you gave in originally. I mean, you just graduate the thing in both directions.
I didn't get the what you were driving at by inequity as opposed to inequality.
Oh, well, what I'm saying is nobody wants perfect equality of income distribution. In fact, we wouldn't even know what that means.
Yeah, but I know. And then what's inequity?
Well, I don't know. I didn't answer the question. I didn't answer what inequity is. Well, I was just saying that when we start talking about the problem of inequality, we really mean the problem of inequity, because we don't want perfect equality. At least I don't think we do.
No, I don't see where there's inequity either, because people get paid according to what they're worth, so to speak. Where's the inequity in that?
Well, okay, well, all right. It's a good point. Many people certainly do not feel that capitalism distributes income in an inequitable fashion. They will argue that capitalism distributes to each contributor according to the value of his contribution. Huh? That's what you mean. Yeah. And economic theory tends to support that. I mean, the economic theorists like to demonstrate that in a perfectly competitive economy, each factor of production, now that means each agent that is contributing to the process of producing anything at all, will receive as a reward, as a wage or interest, or depending on what kind of resource it is, it will receive as a reward the value of its marginal product. That means it will receive as a reward the value of that additional product that was due to its specific contribution. Now that can be logically proved under a regime of perfect competition, which is a logical construct and that never has existed. The trouble with this, and this theorem, is that one, it takes for granted the initial distribution of these resources. You see, in other words, it may be true, let's suppose it is true, that every productive factor, I mean, every hammer and every human being and every acre of land and every drill press receives the value of its contribution to the total product. And that means the owner of it, you know, gets it. Is that equitable? Well, what if one guy started off owning 400,000 drill presses and another guy started off owning nothing? Well, you can push the argument back one step and say, well, he owns 400,000 drill presses because he worked hard and saved. Well, and I say, but he didn't. As a matter of fact, he's a playboy. He's just run through his 13th wife. And they say, yeah, but his father worked hard and saved. So we check that, and we find he didn't either. We go back, it turns out it was Grandpa. All right, now we look at Grandpa, and it turns out that Grandpa was lucky. Which, you know, could have. Grandpa just, you know, happened to be in the New York one day when he cornered the gold market. And, now, I don't want to get into the question of, you know, how the great American fortunes were built, or how fortune generally is acquired. I think, though, we would all have to admit that ownership of large quantities of resources by anyone, as against the ownership of small quantities of resources, is a function of native intelligence, early environment, pluck and stamina, willingness to risk, sheer luck. maybe you have to include in luck, being born in the right country or the wrong country. You see, and maybe this makes it, will be a vivid example. If I had the skills of a diamond cutter, I would receive a high wage. The value of my marginal product would be very high in a society which placed a high value on diamonds. Or if I am a brain surgeon, I can receive $75,000 to $100,000 a year as the value of my marginal product in the United States, but not in India, where the society is so poor that the value of the marginal product of a brain surgeon is almost nothing. That society is compelled to let someone with a brain tumor die. It does not have the resources to get rid of the tumor and save his life. Well, right, now, you know, I don't know, Russ. When you start considering how people acquired ownership of these resources, can one still say that and of course that begs the question even of whether American economy is perfectly competitive. It's not perfectly competitive. It may be adequately competitive. But when you take all these things into account, is one really willing to say with any kind of assurance that the distribution of income that capitalism affects is equitable?
Well, that's your perception, like you said, but I don't think I identified or haven't gotten the money on a lucky speculation. And that still being around two generations later is very difficult.
No, certainly not. Yeah.
I think most people have more than have a pretty good share of resources have earned a lot of it themselves and have it because they spent their money on capital goods rather than on consumer goods. In other words, the money that a person puts in stock, he could have put in cars and women and wives.
Yeah.
The fact that he could have spent the money on something he could use himself, he should get something in return for putting it in the capital good.
Well, okay.
It's fair and equitable. The person who has given up something else to buy capital goods should have a return from it. Did she get the assessment of it?
All right, let me grant that for purposes of argument or to avoid argument. And Well, he said it's equitable. It's only fair that the person who saves, who doesn't spend it on wine, women, and automobiles, but on, because song is cheap, but on stock and saves and buys drill presses, that he should get a return on that. All right, let's grant that. We still have the problem, and I think this is what we're usually concerned with. We occasionally get exercised, and our very, very left-wing people get exercised about the wealthy. But in this country, it is not so much concerned with the great fortunes as it is concerned for the very poor that is prompting us to say we must do something about the inequality of income distribution. I do not think that we are going to move toward a negative income tax because we feel that the rich don't deserve what they got, but rather because we feel that the poor don't deserve what they got. And you just look at one very large group in our society, black people, and they don't deserve what they got.
Well, then it seems like that's welfare and doesn't come under the area of capitalism at all.
No. Well, is welfare inconsistent with capitalism? Milton Friedman.
We're giving them more than they earn by their own efforts, and that's simply humanitarianism, or they're trying to be Christian through the government to seeing people in need and sharing with them. But I don't think it has anything to do with capitalism.
Well, okay. Yeah.
As I listen to you and your approach so far, I gather you're not attempting to equate capitalism as against communism or socialism. You say what's wrong with capitalism.
I'm trying to look at the American economy as she's really functioning today. Yeah, our economy, which we call capitalistic. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little louder so the people back here?
What the poor actually lack is education. I think we should educate them too.
She says what the poor actually lack is education, and we should educate them too. Yeah.
I'd like to argue that everybody is entitled to do a school system for existing freedom through the eighth grade, in fact, the high school. And there's too many young people that are pulling away that option to complete the where we live in Seattle.
I can see a direction in which this is going, and I'll let it go that way. I wish that every American who reads would read a number of books, and he says he won't read number. I would pick one out as maybe the most comprehensive and definitive, Silberman's Crisis in Black and White. And especially now in this context, the chapter on the beer can in the cotton patch. We're touching now on the problem of black in this society. When you talk about kids in the inner city, you're talking about black kids mainly. And we white Americans have not and do not understand what our system, our racist system, has done to black people. How it has created apathy and frustration. And there are so many books today that are bringing this out, some of them in a beautiful fashion. Eldridge Cleaver's Soul on Ice, which is down there in the bookstore, I noticed, for sale. The autobiography of Malcolm X, a new little paperback that's been produced by two black psychiatrists called Black Rage. there are others too. And this book by a white man, Charles Silberman, Crisis in Black and White, which maybe will get through to white people better than the others because it's written by a white man, you know, and he stands in our shoes and talks. I'm not speaking as an economist now, and I have no special insights into the problem of race as an economist, but I feel deeply as I feel on any social issue, that we white people have to do whatever is necessary, take some extraordinary steps to understand the mind of the black man in this society today. What it has meant, what it has done to people, to know that no matter what they do, no matter what handicaps they overcome, no matter how much education they get, they'll always be black. And even if you're Ralph Bunche, you're subject at any time to be told, step to the back of the bus, or we don't want you here. Imagine what it means to live with that threat hanging continually over you. Imagine what it means to little kids coming up through the schools to know, because daddy and mommy have told them all their lives, you can never be nothing because you're a nigger. And don't get uppity because the man will clobber you. Don't be too ambitious, because that's a pushy nigger. What happens to a kid like that? He drops out. And you know, when we talk now about we're going to have to educate these people, I think we are going down a path that we have tried too long. We're going to have to give them the resources to educate themselves. Again, I'm not speaking as an economist now or any kind of authority. I'm just one who's read on this subject and talked to a lot of black militants and not so militant blacks and not so black militants. And I'm as deeply persuaded on this issue as I am on any social issue whatsoever, that we are going to have to turn resources over to the black communities and tell them, you educate your children the way you want them educated. For too long, we've been even dispensing education as a gracious favor which the white community kindly deigns to provide the blacks in the hope that they too will climb and attain the American dream. And if they do climb,
educate themselves, and they don't know this, how we derive that education. I mean, I've been dealing with this problem for long. We have model city programs. You can see all along these people don't have the ability to organize these things. Now, their last letter I got, they want to fire the representatives to the council because they're not getting anything done. They're good people, these people who do that.
Well, at the very least, we white people have to be aware of the fact that we've made mistakes and we've botched it and we don't understand it perfectly. Doesn't mean we do nothing and that we don't know nothing. It means that we have to listen and be terribly open to what's happening, and willing to adjust and change. And And to be on our white horse out charging somewhere today and to admit that tomorrow, though we may have been charging in the right direction yesterday, tomorrow that may be the wrong direction. We're not going to overcome the results of 350 years of slavery and of legal and illegal slavery overnight. We're not going to change the consciousness that we have imbued in people just like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I think this is happening to a lot of poor white people too. I mean, the same thing that has happened to black people. I couldn't join sorority because I didn't have any money. I had to work, and everything I earned went to pay for the tuition and books. And I didn't have the clothes that would allow me to even participate in these sorority activities. So there's a lot of structure there that applies to everybody, not just a lot.
You don't have to have a good education to have a good income. A lot of people, probably people here, didn't go past the sixth or eighth grade and have a little bit of income. Just because you educate people doesn't mean you're going to help their economy or make them more productive in helping themselves. I think that the money we're pouring in now is 10% or 11% of the population that commits over 50% of the crimes in the United States is a waste of money. We're just throwing our money away.
What would you do as an alternative?
No, I really don't know what to do about this thing. What we, it looks like what we're doing isn't right. I think if the people don't want to help themselves, I'd pay them an already group like the Japanese to help themselves.
Party?
I have a feeling that I believe in education, but I have a feeling that education is just about as complicated as the money system. What I'm trying to say, education is strictly from the money base instead of from the love of what we like or enjoy doing. Everybody goes, I wouldn't be a millionaire if I had a chance. I wouldn't know what to do with it. A lot of people who live by the dollar instead of love.
Cordy, you're still right. Education today, in college at least, is for to equip people to make money that they won't know what to do with when they got it, instead of to teach them to love something. Yeah, boy, you want to be president of my school when I start it? Somebody over here had it. People sometimes talk about the guaranteed income and the negative income tax as if they were the same thing. Economists distinguish between the guaranteed income scheme would say everybody, no matter what, is guaranteed an income of so many dollars a year. And you have to juggle that maybe according to the size of the family and so on. But in other words, if you work, let's say you settle at $3,000. Everybody's guaranteed $3,000. So you work and earn $2,000, that means the government pays you an additional $1,000. You don't work and earn nothing, the government pays you $3,000. Well, there's a real problem there. That means there's a strong disincentive to work. So almost all economists favor some kind of negative income tax, which means that yet you will get a percentage of the difference between your income and some figure, so that the more you earn for yourself, the more you get. Thus, you always have an incentive to work. Now, the details of this get very, very complicated, and I'm sure you don't want to be bored with them here. There's a lot of literature on it. If you get back home, go to your public library, look up in the Reader's Guide or the Periodical Index of the Social Sciences, look for negative income tax, and you find plenty of references, and you can read until you're purple in the head and find out what all of the difficulties are. I simply made the prediction that we would move in this direction within a few years. I may be wrong about that. I want to make one comment on the whole business of inequality or inequity, whether it exists or doesn't. I think there's a good deal of inequity anyhow. As an economist now, I would say if we want to do something about the inequity of income distribution or the inequality, let's do it sensibly. You can think of resources times price equals income for most people. In other words, you own resources, maybe just your brain or your muscle, or maybe a factory or something. Well, the price of those resources command in the marketplace times the quantity of the resources you got determines your income. And what we've gotten into the habit of doing is every time we don't like the way income is distributed, we jiggle with these prices. And that is foolish for a number of reasons. First of all, say you don't like, you don't like the way the poor people, the people picking tomatoes. You don't like their low incomes. So you raise the price of tomato pickers. And what happens? You destroy their resource. Now the farmers don't want as many tomato pickers. And their income probably drops. A few people will do better, but lots of people will do much worse. Or another example, let's take the other thing. You don't like the fact that Nelson Rockefeller is making so much, and what he's doing is making it off of Penn Central Railroad bonds. So he owns a lot of bonds times the price, you know, that he gets on those bonds equals his income. So you push down the price, that is the interest rate. Well, man, you've got to destroy a lot of widows and orphans before you do much to Nelson Rockefeller. I mean, if you really want to be a radical, go into his safe deposit box and take his bonds, attack this. Well, now, this is a noxious habit we've gotten into, and we do it all the time. Every time we don't like the distribution of income, we go out and jiggle the prices. Okay, so here's a poor group, so we then raise the minimum wage. That's a price jiggling. And we ignore the unemployment effect of this kind of thing. Milton Friedman says another example of this is all of our welfare programs, which provide all kinds of crazy disincentives to people. So he says, let's abolish all of this, this whole business of fussing around, including the police state aspects of the welfare programs, you know, where if you're on welfare, the social worker's got a right to come around and snoop and see whether you got a telephone or whether a man's sneaking in, and that we're actually providing incentives for men to leave the house so that the wife can get more welfare. Abolish all of this and just set up a program where people get income and they do with it as they please. And one consequence of that is that the economy will function more smoothly. You won't be messing with the prices, which are the signals that the economy depends on. Another thing is that you will not be perpetuating this kind of dependence that a welfare system perpetuates. And it really does. And we're breeding through our welfare system the second and third generation of dependents. Sure, people are going to be saying, those poor people, you know what they'll do? They'll go out and they'll spend it on booze. You only have a right to spend it on booze if you're wealthy. Well, maybe they will spend it, but I don't know if they ever learn not to spend it on booze, if indeed they're spending it on booze, unless they get a little practice. One other thing that, as an economist, I talked about how growing affluence in a society destroys many of the things upon which relatively poor people depend, like public transportation. I would like to see us move in the direction of providing free of charge a large number of consumer goods. And I've got a rule here. If there is any consumer good for which the demand is highly inelastic, there's a strong case for making it free. Now, the demand is inelastic if you were to graph the price versus the quantity of it that people want to buy, you'd get a very steep curve. And it's elastic if, when you graph the quantity that people want to buy against the price, you get a very horizontal curve. In other words, the demand for something is inelastic when people buy about the same amount no matter what the price. Good example, salt. 12 cents a pound, 30 cents a pound. You could triple, quadruple, even buy that steak a month. Now, if the demand for something is highly inelastic, there's a good case for making it free of charge. Especially if it is something that is kind of fundamental to people. Because see, when you make it free of charge, you lower the price to zero. But because the demand is inelastic, people won't take that much more. A good example that has recently come up is the New York subway system. Think how much money New York spends every year trying to collect those subway tolls. But the demand for the subway is highly inelastic. If you made it free of charge, people wouldn't ride the subway that much more. And if they did, that might be good. And you could take those resources that you're now spending on collecting the tolls and devote them to, say, having somebody riding the subway to prevent people from tearing up the seats. There are many examples of things like this. And I mean, there are some examples, too, of things where the demand is not inelastic. We should be very, very careful of, and one I want to single out, is medical care. The demand for medical care is extremely elastic. Which means that when the government makes medical care cheaper, it aggravates the problem of adequate medical care. See, we do not at present have, for all kinds of reasons, including monopolistic forces in the American Medical Association, we do not now have adequate medical services in this country. And when we, by lowering the price, cause people to buy more and more and more, we're just aggravating the problem. The problem of medical care of all kinds is going to have to be attacked on the supply side, not the demand side. We're not going to fuss with the price or Medicare and Medicaid and all these things are extremely stopgap measures. And I'm willing to go along with the argument, though I'm not sure what it means, that everybody's entitled to medical care as a kind of a human democratic right. The reason I don't know what that means is, the real question is how much medical care is entitled to. All right, so my appendix is about to burst. As an American, I'm entitled to have it taken out, no matter how poor I am. I'll grant that. But what if I got the sniffles? What am I entitled to? What if I got a wart on my nose? What if my teeth are falling out? Okay, but what if one of them's a little crooked? And these are the kinds of, you know, of problems that you have to resolve. I'm not saying don't mess with medicine because the demand is elastic. I'm saying don't make it free of charge. I'm afraid we're going to have a pricing system in medicine to ration out the scarce resources, to keep people from pestering the heck out of their doctors and cluttering up the hospitals. Now, I want to be sure that people who need medical care have enough medical care around. And that's one reason why I don't want the hypochondriacs littering the hospital. Yeah, George?
Well, can you give us another example of this inelastic situation? One of them, the New York subway system bothers me.
Well, I would say the whole system of public transportation in cities.
Well, but the aspect that seems to be missing here is, if there is no income from fares, who pays for equipment maintenance, for salaries, for the
Yeah, the taxpayer would have to come out of public revenues. I'm saying,
so it's really not free, you're just paying for it in different
ways. It is free to the consumer.
But then the consumer turns around and pays increased taxes to public.
Yes, yeah, sure. It's an alternate way of paying for it. Yes, everything has to be paid for. There ain't no such thing as a free lunch. I'm saying some things it makes sense to make the consumer pay for, like medical care, in order to ration it out. Other things it makes much less sense. For example, you know, this isn't so such a terrible principle. Look at the public highways. Did you drive out here on any interstate highway? Who paid for that? The taxpayer. You got it free of charge. Why? We could have made people pay tolls. We decided the costs of collecting it are, you know, not worth it. And we also make a judgment, you know, somebody isn't going to decide, heck, I think I'll drive from Butte to Missoula this afternoon because it's free. You know, sure, a few more people will take it because it's free than would have taken it if it weren't free. But by and large, we said the demand is so inelastic that we don't need to use price to ration. Now, I think in our cities, this is definitely not the case with the highways, and yet we've neglected this principle. In the cities, we have allowed we've used this principle on the automobile expressways. We've let them be free of charge, and look at the mess. We should have been using it with the public transportation system.
Yeah.
method?
No, I don't think you get a mess there, because there are enormous economies of scale with the public transportation system. But I don't want to get hung up. We got off on this the other day, and none of what I have to say is definitive. I want to just get you thinking about some of these things and supplying your own examples and counterexamples.
Well, but city streets, I can see that it makes a lot of sense not to try to charge people for them because of the extreme complexity of the collection system, and maybe you'd have to pay to do it. But when it comes to something like salt, I don't see why you say it makes sense, because then you have the problem of having to pay all the distributors and everything. It makes sense to me just to leave it.
Yeah, no, I use salt as an example of an inelastic demand. I did not use salt as one that I would like to have the price removed from. No, I believe salt should still be sold in the grocery store. Yeah. No, things that I have in mind are the big things. Schools, parks, public transportation. We tend to do this with schools. We tend to do it with parks. I haven't gone nearly far enough, in my view, with public transportation. But if we search around, I think we can find some other kinds of social services that I think could be made available to all, and that would do a good deal toward eliminating the subjective pains of poverty. And to keep in mind the public parks as an example. This is no un-American principle. We don't throw up our hands in horror and say, parks run by the government, socialism. You know, we accept it. We just say it's something that should be provided to all the citizens free of charge. Let me quickly, I'm going to have to quit and reserve all these other things for next time. Low growth. One of the criticisms that has been leveled against capitalism, and especially American capitalism since around 1960, now here over against socialism, is that it doesn't promote a high enough rate of economic growth. On this, I have a clear position. I can't say it in this mixed company. I see no need for, no desire for, a higher rate of economic growth. I'm not going to stifle economic growth. I'm certainly not opposed to new products being developed because people want new products or because technicians discover ways of producing new products. I am definitely opposed to the government stepping in and trying to soup up the rate of economic growth. We don't need it. We don't. It's silly to me to say that we've got to grow faster, produce more goods and services at a faster rate. It's patently ridiculous. Capitalism has demonstrated a fantastic ability to stimulate economic growth, and socialism has demonstrated, I think most economists are now agreeing, no particular talents in this area. The rapid rate of growth of Russia was due not to socialism, as the Russian economists are now admitting, not to their system of centrally planned inputs and outputs, so much as to their system of forced saving. In other words, if you compel the citizenry to save annually 35% of their total output, and you plow that back into investment, you'll get a rapid rate of economic growth. And that's why the Soviet Union grew so rapidly. One of the leading Soviet economists, a man named Novoselov, now says that the Russian rate of economic growth was half what it would have been had their system of central planning not been so inefficient. And even in the period of Russia's most rapid economic growth, she did not exceed the rate of growth that the United States attained in the last three decades of the 19th century. And when you make percentage comparisons, of course, you have to remember that the Russians started from a much smaller base. Can you imagine somebody growing 100% in 1 year? I can, if he's small enough when he starts. Okay. Where's Raul? I don't know whether he's going to find it. I got it. You know, it would be nice. I'll take two more minutes. Just at least get you thinking about this, and then come back to it next time. Monopoly. You know, is the American economy, who's asking, is the American economy today dominated by monopoly? Or let me put the argument this way, as many people do. There was a time when American capitalism functioned. Well, there you are. American capitalism functioned well. I'll quit. 1 minute. because it was competitive, and there were a lot of little merchants and manufacturers and shoe polish salesmen struggling against one another, and so the American economy worked well. But nowadays, the economy is controlled by a few giant corporations, monopoly and oligopoly. How many of you have heard the word oligopoly? Yeah, it's even passed into literature, a technical term, an abomination. It rules the economy, and so it doesn't work well, and so we're going to have to do something, whatever that is. Well, let's, if you're here, let's come back to that argument, and I want to try to persuade you that it's a lot of bunk. That the economy, I, on the basis of a good deal of evidence, I think economists, bourgeois economists, have come to the conclusion that that's pretty much baloney. The American economy is probably more competitive today than it was at the turn of the century. So that fits in with all the prejudices that you entertain. Well, now you get another chance to stretch.